connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
You there. What year is it?
Hang on, let me just check my watch here. Okay, it's saying I should check my phone because the watch is low battery. It is 2025? And that can't be
right.
Oh, wait,
it's still 2025? I thought I was asleep for longer than that.
Yeah, I know I was asleep a lot longer than that.
I opened a box in the mountains, and I thought it made me fall asleep for, like, I don't know, longer.
Yeah, I've actually been asleep training in a training pod, training on how to be a better comedian.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, I was in the hyperbaric timing chamber.
Hyperbaric timing chamber?
Yes.
Sorry, I lost a bit of my old man rasp there. It seems like my younger years haven't quite gone away.
Yeah, that's going to be a bit of a problem if we're going to talk. You do need to be consistent with your voice if you're going to, like, be in an audio format, which we currently are. If you look over to the left, you're actually on Pranked Podcast.
I'm on a podcast?
Yep.
I thought those had gone away by now.
Yeah, we all thought them extinct.
Ever since JD Vance got one.
Yeah, unfortunately, when JD Vance was asked to be on a guest on a podcast, they just all sort of went away.
Did they ever find liberal Joe Rogan?
His name is Hassan Piker,
I think. Oh,
yeah.
The Twitch streamer?
Yeah, I know. Apparently Ninja's getting into podcasts as well. Not the Twitch streamer Ninja. An actual Ninja is getting into podcasts.
Is he, like, answering questions?
Yeah.
About what it means to be a ninja, and it's kind of actually racist, and
yeah, it's
probably
really
not worth revisiting in retrospect.
It's a little bit old internet, and yet simultaneously everything that's old is new again. I mean, just look at
me.
Yeah, just look at you, am I right?
I'm new again.
Oh,
my youth
thank goodness.
Been restored by chanting this ancient spell, everything old is new again. The reversal of fortunes and entropy has been upon us.
And that was only spurred on by my jokes, which I learned in the hyperbaric timing chamber. And thankfully, the entire scene comes to close in a nice simple bow that we can now never refer to again, so that the rest of this episode ages significantly better.
Yeah, our episode about that's gonna age better because we talk about, let's see, memes from a month ago, games from 2 to 3 months ago.
A game that is popular specifically within the 2024 and 2025 years.
Yeah, so let's just kick it off. Welcome back to Talk Surfer Show.
A whirlwind ride through whatever we want. I'm, of course, your host this week, Galen, and with me is the co-host,
Matthew Marissa. And yeah, it's been a hot minute. Real life has been real.
And life.
Yeah, so.
And also hot. It's been hot.
It's so summer right now.
Yeah, we're very much in the summer of 2025, the summer of our discontent.
It was the summer of 25. Every time I hear that song, I have to go nice during the chorus. So, yeah, speaking of hot things.
Yeah, so the hottest thing right now is probably going to be Mario Kart?
No, this is where we do the State of the Meme intro.
Oh, right.
It's something I edit in.
Yeah, okay. You can just edit all this out.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And of course, the hottest. Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. I thought you were going to.
So, okay.
We're going to just go to the State of the Meme.
Yeah. So, the State of the Meme, this is something that's a bit already passed now. It had an actual finale, but like, we still got to talk about it because it's quite a good, strong front runner for meme of the year already.
It was a moment in time, and it was very, very fun. The internet came together and decided that a bunch of little blobby MS Paint fellas were horses in a horse race.
So, horse race tests started as a prototype by @SnakesAndrews on Twitter, who makes a lot of like goofy game prototypes that are usually a little surreal and silly, and just post little clips of them. This was sort of like the DVD logo bouncing around. It was these identical looking MS Paint blobs.
Yeah.
That were all different colors, but essentially they were all just bouncing around an MS Paint painted like room.
Yeah.
There wasn't much detail to it other than the DVD logo bouncing.
Yeah, the when we say MS Paint blobs, I don't necessarily know that they were one-to-one identical, but they were all essentially just like a strange MS Paint A, you know?
Yeah.
With a like sort of blobbish nose and then two stick legs, and yeah, that's it.
Kind of an Amogus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. You might, I feel as though historians are going to look back on this and say that Amogus perhaps fueled a little bit into the popularity of this.
Yeah. So, at the start, they were all the same shape, just different colors. But pretty soon, this started gaining a bit of traction, and Snakes Andrews started adding things to it. The first thing was an objective, a goal to reach, a, like, small box, essentially, that when one of the horses would get to it, it would end the video. And then pretty soon as well, there were a few more updates made, adding sound effects and just sounds in general, adding more different shapes for each horse so that they were different, like, characters or figures now. Not just different colors, but different, slight differences in shape. Yeah,
just enough to differentiate them.
Yeah. And then the goal box was changed to a carrot. And this is when things started to really start cooking. So each post is, like, a list of, like, numbers and characters, so things like track 2, race 1, and track 2, race 2.
Yeah, it's like Doom, like Doom Wad, you know, yeah, structure of, like, episode and mission.
Yeah, exactly. E1, M1, H1, N1.
Yeah.
Yeah, So, not only that, but so as this was going, eventually, what happened was that one horse reached the carrot during one of these posts, and it showed a picture of a horse painted orange, because this was the orange horse.
Yep.
And it was given a name.
Yes.
Jovial Merriment. So this begins the actual, like, development of horse race tests.
The meta-narrative, you might say.
So I think at this point, it went from prototype to more of a involved shitpost, essentially.
Yeah.
What is worth noting is that as this started going, fans started picking up on it. It gained fans. It gained a fandom. And then people started speculating about it. A big part of this is because people love rooting for things and forming little teams and divisions.
Yeah.
So as more horses started winning, every time a horse won, they would get a name. Some of these, for example, are brown, which is doorknob, white, superstitional realism, blue, bulletin board, but with an apostrophe.
Yeah, bullet apostrophe N.
Yellow, lightning strikes thrice. We already mentioned orange, which is jovial merriment. Gray, downtown skybox, which is one of my favorites. Red, resolute mind afternoon. And pink, comely material morning. So, great names.
All very, very good horse names.
Yeah, but people started, like, developing characters for these, developing, like, lore fan-made. For example, Jovial Merriment wins a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Note that this is mostly a random thing. The horses just go in a straight line until they bounce off of anything, be it another horse or a wall.
And I want to note that while there is a, like, it's kind of like a marble run where it's, you know, a simulation of very simple mechanics where they hit a wall and I feel as though theoretically there is a logic of how it will bounce.
Yeah.
But because a lot of the time the areas themselves are also made in MS Paint and, like, for example, have, you know, no aliasing or anything like that. So if a rough hallway has, like, strange jagged edges after swiping at it, then that strange jagged edge means every time a horse hits a wall, something different is going to happen.
Yeah.
You really can't predict it until it, like, reaches certain thresholds.
A lot of it is done without the use of line tool, and a lot of it is done with the use of the circle tool.
Yeah.
To intentionally create things where the hitboxes are so awkward. Because it seems to be not even using hitbox collision, but pixel collision, which means that it can do weird things.
Yeah.
A lot of game designers will not use pixel collision because it's actually sort of imprecise and can be unintuitive, but it makes for a more exciting race. Also, the speed they move at is seemingly random.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll hit a wall and go turbo fast, and sometimes they'll just crawl away from it.
What? Yeah. From having watched it, it seems as though if they go longer without hitting something, they do go a little bit faster, as if to, like, get them to the next bounce quicker. But Beyond that, I think it's mostly just that they all go basically the same speed with very slight variations. And then as the race goes on, they do gradually get quicker and quicker and quicker, such that eventually it will get to an end point.
Yeah. I want to continue with sort of the plot, I'll
yeah, the,
say.
The overarching
so one,
narrative.
One big moment that I think really kicked off the fandom is the Jovial Backshots incident,
yeah.
Where there was a track that had a little corner that was like a soccer goal, like a U-shaped box, where the top was open, but the rest was walls. In Jovial Merriment and Lightning Strikes Thrice, which is yellow, got stuck there. They kind of just went back and forth, up and down on each other.
Yeah.
I'll let you understand what happens next. Fans did their thing and made fan art and started shipping, which leads us to the next important moment. And I think, I think there's a lot of times where people love to make lore where there isn't. The big comparison I make to this is Twitch Plays Pokemon, where obviously there is an element of the normal story of Pokemon, but fans who were watching and interacting with it made up completely new things that are outside the realm of gameplay and story within Pokemon.
Yeah.
Things like Lord Helix.
Yeah.
Not a thing in Pokemon. Literally was just because they kept opening the item bag and looking at an item that was the Helix fossil, but they were able to deride significance from this seemingly chaotic random action, and they kind of force that to happen multiple times, that the creation of lore from seemingly no detail was a big appeal to that. However, Horse Race Test does have that to an extent, but I think at this point it's hard to argue that the creator of it, Snakes Andrews, did not have ideas. I think Snakes Andrews had intention here. Because we get to White and Cyan. Cyan, I didn't mention. Cyan is a loser.
Yeah.
Never won a single race. White at the time didn't either. So they were put together in hell, essentially.
Yeah.
A shared cell where it was just them two in an area that was very boxy with long straight corridors and rooms that were actually square. This was made using line tool and square tool. And in the center of it was the carrot. They battled it out for a long time.
It became a running bit because we got the beginning of the losers, the losers race. And it's, a 1 minute clip or whatever. But by the end of the 1 minute clip, I don't think we've even breached the first room. Like, we might have gotten to the second one, but we're not anywhere near the end of the race, and so it just cuts off. And then we, the next post would be the next of the main races, and we would check in with the losers every now and again.
Yeah, with the main races not having White or Cyan. So, at the end of this race, White got their name Superstitional Realism and rejoined the rest of the group, where Cyan was put into an empty room with no inner walls, no curves, no anything, no obstacles, and was given a free carrot in Cyan's name, Cyan. So after that, though, Cyan still didn't join the main group because there was another race or two with just the main group. And I think, Red got their win and JM, Jovial Merriment, got a bunch of wins and etc. Cut to Cyan in actual hell, surrounded by nightmare horses.
Yep.
These are other shapes that are, darker colors, a bit sickly in a way, and every horse either has an acronym for its name, like JM or DK for doorknob, under the horse the whole time, or it has just their color, cyan or green, which is the other unnamed one. The nightmare horses have, numbers, 006 or 00B, a lot of, hex colors, or hex numbers, I guess. The nightmare horses also, they win.
Yeah.
And when they win, it's not just a picture of a horse that's colored, it's also distorted and edited and, glitched.
Yeah.
Data moshed.
If Garbage Bin is the one I'm thinking of, it is it's had the swirl tool used on it.
Yeah.
You know?
In specific places, mind you.
Yeah.
So its legs were swirly and weird.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. They actually kind of creep me out a little. Give me the ghiblies.
There are a couple. I think there's one where the face is copy pasted over and over again. And it does look a little strange. Like, a couple of them are, like, just a little bit disconcerting. Not in a way that's necessarily scary, but in a way that's, like,
unsettling.
Yeah.
I love it. Also because the nightmare horses have the same shapes as the regular horses. Except for, I don't think Cyan has a copy in it. So, Cyan does not win any races in Hell.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, Superstitional Realism and Jovial Merriment are sent to Hell. They literally leave the main group and show up to try to essentially help Cyan.
Yeah.
They're put into Hell. But they don't win either. There's essentially, there was a bunch of races and then one final huge one with all the nightmare horses, Cyan, JM, and Superstitional Realism, White. One of the nightmare horses wins this race. Then there's a break, and then the season finale was announced.
Yep.
This was premiered on Lumpy Touch's YouTube channel. Lumpy Touch is a pixel artist known for doing, like, horror parodies of Garfield, big in the Garfield horror scene. Also, the like, Garfield shmup is incredible that they made. Check that out. They've got really cool stuff. Just really solid pixel artist and animator. But they had nothing to do with the production of Horse Race Test. They just offered to host it, I'm pretty sure. Because at this point, Horse Race Test had become an entire movement.
Yeah.
It grew to be such a huge fandom. And I'll talk about that in a second. But to sum it up, the season finale was a tournament of all remaining members, but notably there wasn't JM or Cyan or White. There were three completely different horses that were, like, stitched up and weren't the same name. They had different names.
Yeah, we had weird freak horses. Also, should be noted, by the way, some choice names from the Nightmare Horses include Garbage Bin, which is just fun, Nighttime Knifemare, FFF is Fantasy Fantasy Fantasy, and my favorite, you mentioned 00B, that my friends, is Oob.
Well, no, there's 00B, and then there's Oob. They're two different horses.
Oh, right, I forgot, it's even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Because there's also, like, 006 and then probably 006, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Like, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
God.
So, yeah, in Snakes, Andrews kind of poked a little fun at the lore havers, being like, no, that's not JM and White. Those are just completely new horses. Yeah. Nothing to do with them. At the same time, the fact that those horses were left in the hellscape, the nightmare zone, and were replaced by new nightmare horses is like, come on.
Yeah.
It's great because there's just enough of actual writing to, like, actually hook people in, but it's also open enough to let the fans do things.
Yeah.
One thing is that Snakes Andrews has essentially said there's no canon gender for the horses, so fans are free to draw them however they want, which I think is actually kind of really fun.
Yeah.
A lot of people have taken this to draw the horses, if you're drawing, like, a humanized version, for example, I mean, to draw them, like, androgynously, because there's no gender for them, to draw them more genderless in terms of appearance. But just the fact that the creator is kind of letting fans have their fun in encouraging that is really cool to me. Of course, there are people who have designs that have been sort of reused and appreciated, but I think the fact that all you really need is, like, Uma Musume style horse details.
Yeah.
By the way, the fact that Uma Musume is, like, for some reason popping off tremendously now, coinciding with this, is so incredibly ridiculous.
Horses are in. Bet on horse girls.
Cygames sponsored the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
They sponsored the Kentucky Derby this year because of the horse racing girl anime. And that's the same, that was like the same weekend of the Horse Race Test finale.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
We're gonna have a horse girl summer, all right?
So I wanted to bring this up because obviously it's great. I love it. Frontrunner meme of the year. But I think this calls back to a lot of older, like, absolute top tiers. Goncharov.
Yep.
The red necklace, which is, or the crimson necklace, which is a similar, like, story that doesn't exist and people make fandom memes out of.
Yeah.
I mentioned Twitch Plays Pokemon. There's shades of Gels Marble Runs. or Gels Marble Races, which is the person that just does marble races like in sand and stuff.
Yeah.
And people have developed followings of like the certain marbles and rooting for them, which Gels Marble Races was kind of the reason why those marble race video games for streamers became a thing.
Yeah.
But then this also reminds me so much of Blazeball.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That was the immediate point that I wanted to point to as well.
Yes. Blazeball, I don't remember if we've ever really talked about it much, but it was a sort of incremental game social experiment where you chose a fake Blazeball team to root for, and you would be able to bet on them using, I think, peanuts. But eventually, you would also be able to use your earnings to steal members from other teams, to give your team bonuses, not just corked bats, but other random bullshit. One team bought a pitching machine to use as a pitcher.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, people would be able to vote for new, like, orders to be enacted within the league, which included things like summoning a crab god in Blood Rain.
It, like, one of the most famous storylines surrounded a character who, at one point, like, I believe that they were the best pitcher in the league, but at one point they, like, died. But the community realized that, like, when you could vote to, like, switch around a player onto a different team, they could still switch around that player. And so they did that, and they became, like, NAN. Like, you know, not available. So, like, the character transformed,
yeah,
by right of, you know, this strange interaction that the fans realized.
Yeah, the fans kind of exploited the system, and the devs were like, okay, we'll run with that.
Yeah.
And made the character a zombie. And then there was a zombie apocalypse. And part of the appeal of Blazeball was that you don't see anything. It's all spreadsheets, like sports statistics.
Yeah.
But you see the names, at least, and you're able to come up with concepts surrounding that. There is a whole bit of fan art, like a huge amount of fan art, because people would just be like, oh, there's this player on my team with a funny name. What do they look like? What's their backstory? And the community aspect of it was that, like, people would yes and so heavily that a large amount of the details for, like, characters and entire teams was just invented by fans, and the devs were very welcoming of that.
Yeah.
There is a really good documentary by People Make Games about this.
Yep.
And I was a Seattle Garages fan, by the way, where the whole band was in a garage band, or the whole team was in a garage band together, except one guy who had broken off due to creative differences.
I was the San Francisco Lovers, the team mm-hmm. that was an entire polycule.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of those details, especially the bit about the guy who broke off from the band, weren't written by the Blazeball devs. That was just a fan concept that was so funny, people stuck with it.
Yeah.
So I think Blazeball was a great example of, like, there's just enough information to educate it. People aren't going to argue over headcanons as much. But also because there's a lack of information for other things, it gives fans more room to grow and do things, I guess. Yeah. Come up with stuff.
It's like there is authorial structure, but there is not necessarily authorial voice, authorial intent.
Yeah, there's sort of writing prompts in a way.
Yeah.
Is that there is enough information to get you going, but it's more about allowing people to have fun.
Yeah.
I think there is sort of an aspect of fandom as activity where it's not about being a fan of something, but the actions, behaviors, fun, enjoyable parts of being part of a fandom. These are ways to exercise those without having to be a fan of something.
Yeah.
Because, like, to some extent, the horses and horse race tests don't matter. I mean, I say that, but, like, people are fans of horse race tests. People are fans of Blazeball. And I think I don't want to undervalue Blazeball too much, especially. But, like, when it comes to things like Goncharov or the Crimson Necklace, or that character on April Fool's that a bunch of artists made fan art of pretending it was an old character people really liked.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Don't remember her name, but she had three eyes and white hair. But those are all people who like the processes of being in a fandom and like to contribute to fan spaces, but they don't have to like really learn an actual series or read an actual series.
You
like,
don't have to read, you don't have you, to you can, watch all of Naruto to start making the fan fiction for Horse Race Tests.
Exactly.
You know?
And like, again, I don't want to undervalue the value of these things, but in a way, Horse Race Tests being this very sort of primitive game prototype lent itself to that.
Yeah,
it was a lot easier to sell itself to people. And again, when people were able to see a blob and imagine what it's like, imagination goes wild. It's like how with horror, it's scarier to imply something than it is to show something oftentimes.
Yeah.
Because the human mind's imagination is able to come up with what they fear most. In this case, you're able to come up with what character wants to boing another character the most.
And it's orange and yellow.
Well, yeah. It's like people's need to find clues and patterns. Yeah. Using the mystery hunting, pattern solving brain in order to find what character you want to draw is like, it's a fun activity.
Yeah, it's social, it's fulfilling in an individual setting, it's very creative. And it's also just, you know, there's just an amount of fun to it. There's an amount of, like, taking the ironic factor of getting really into something that has no conceivable lore and rolling with it.
Mm-hmm. Also, apparently, season 2 has started, I just haven't watched it yet. We found that out while we were doing research for this episode.
Yes, but really good work, really happy to see where it goes, but otherwise just really fun moment to be on the internet of. So we should probably get into the video game corner. We have just a couple of little like what we've been playing, and then we've got one probably bigger topic. Mind if I kick things off?
Yeah, go ahead.
Awesome. So I have been working on and off on a Helldivers 2 script that is now finished. I am in the process of filming it. But what I want to focus in on today is the most recent major order that we have, the most recent major arc that we've had, which is the invasion of Super Earth. So, briefly, let me get you up to speed. Helldivers 2 is a third-person squad-based shooter. It's a game that takes heavy inspiration from Starship Troopers and early 2000s War on Terror America. It is a game that is extremely fun to play with, at this point, what I would say probably one of the best sandboxes that it has had. If you are interested in that sort of thing, you should look into it or you should play it again. But let me focus in on the thing that makes Helldivers 2 the most interesting of the squad-based tactics shooter 4-player PvE MMUP.
It's worth noting this is a horde shooter.
Yeah, this is a horde shooter. That's a very good point. So the thing that makes it most interesting in my view is the Galactic War. So Helldivers 2 is a live service. Live service games are not necessarily inherently bad. For example, Helldivers 2 happens to use it for very good effect because what they use it for is a, like, community-wide D&D game, basically. So the idea is the Galactic War that is currently ongoing with the three main factions you're fighting is on a big persistent map that major things happen to. So, for example, the Terminids that were around before, we had a whole arc where we deployed Termicide on a major planet of theirs, which ended up backfiring and a whole big cloud has just formed that, like, you know, is kind of completely impenetrable. And all the Terminids that are right near it are supercharged, super powerful. That is a very fun example where, like, the community all did a bunch of missions that were very specific to a certain point in time. That all ended up with a big explosive backfiring, but very fun event, like, felt on a whole player base level. Specifically, though, the invasion of Super Earth was what happened when the Illuminate came in. So we had the bugs, the Terminants, like I just said, and the bots, who are, like, robot, sort of Terminator-inspired. But the Illuminates, which were also in the first Helldivers game, were not in it at launch. Instead, they came in when, after we blew up that planet with the Termicide, it became a big black hole. Not a real black hole, as we would later find out it was a portal that the Illuminate came through, but it looked like a big black hole. Well, the Illuminate came through it, you could actually visit it beforehand, and it would have, like, squid noises and, like, deep ocean noises. Yeah, pretty much. The Illuminate came out of it and started immediately spreading across the map. We fought back. the planet then started moving. Like, the planet that we blew up started moving towards Super Earth. And you had to do Illuminate missions specifically in order to get it to slow down. Eventually, we did slow it down, although not before. Notably, it has already destroyed two planets. And I believe the Meridius Bacon is still there. But we slowed it down to a stop. And then out from it came a massive Illuminate invasion force. So, what are the Illuminate? Let me just briefly explain that. They are heavily inspired by, their transportation at least, is heavily inspired by, like, Norman Rockwell aliens. Not Norman Rockwell aliens, Norman Roswell aliens? Is that?
Roswell, New Mexico?
Roswell, New Mexico?
What are you talking about?
It's the, like, you know, Roswell, like, circular dome UFO.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So like, the very Americana...
Yes.
Bob Lazar style.
Yep. Their transportation is, like, yeah, big, you know, domey sort of ships. The Illuminate themselves are kind of like the elites from Halo. Like, they're about that size. And they also turn people into zombies, abstractly. Don't ask me how. The game doesn't care to tell me, and I don't care to learn. But they turn the populace into zombies, and... The end result is that it is a horde enemy that has a lot of individual major units that will sort of pester you or run at you. And then there are also affectionately called tripods, things that are shaped like stalkers from Half-Life 2. They have a massive laser that, like, goes pew and, like, shoots at you. It's great. They're very fun to fight. And the invasion of Super Earth also introduced megacities, which are, like, skyscraper, big cities, just very densely populated. This is a very specific, like, bottle moment in time, because I kind of always said since day one that Helldivers 2 came out, when the Illuminate were introduced was probably when the game was going to be at its best. I have been so deeply vindicated. Like, the Illuminate going to Super Earth has kind of been, I think, probably the best arc so far. At the very least, I think that the sandbox, the weapon balancing, the stratagem balancing, like, they have ironed out a lot of the kinks. It is still kind of a buggy game, unfortunately. I've had matches that ended, not necessarily on my own. But the game is in such a good state. And it could not have been a better time for it to be in such a good state, because it really did need to have a good, like, it really needed to make a good impression during this particular arc, let's just say. But I think it really did succeed. I don't know if Helldivers 2 is going to continue to be an exceptional game. I would bet money that it will continue to be a very good game. I'm continuing to play it myself, but... This one arc, I think, has been one of the most thrilling things. Like, the little details, like, whenever a planet was about to be collided with, all, like, the major order would be to do missions on that planet to, like, you know, extract civilians and extract resources and whatnot. And then you would get to, eventually, when it did collide, see it, you know, hit. The fleet that came out, we had various missions on the planets that they would pass by to get to Super Earth that could, like, delete progress towards the fleet. So when it got to Super Earth, it actually had, like, 80% health. The major order that we had failed because we were, like, we didn't do enough damage to them, I don't think. But we still had only, like, 20% health left to it, so we ended up succeeding by the second one. There was actually a fun story. Last little story I'll tell is that Helldivers 2 did get review bombed because the Chinese player base had been working very, very hard to keep the... Is it Equality on Sea? I think it's Equality on Sea, which was the megacity that was in China. And it ended up, I think, falling. Like, the defense failed when it was, like, 99.7%.
That's sad.
It's really sad, but really funny. Those two cities ended up being the two, like, the main capital city, Prosperity City, and the Chinese city, Equality on Sea, were the two that were held when the invasion was done, which is so good. That made, like, a random local newspaper in China, according to Eurogamer, which is really fun.
One bit I like that you told me about was that the president of Super Earth died at one point.
Yes.
And like the governor general, like the leader of the army, assumed command. And yeah. I was sitting there thinking, like, did this guy do a coup in the middle of their invasion?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, did he shoot the president?
It would make perfect sense. And like, it's exactly the kind of thing that Helldivers 2 would sort of allude to.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. It would make perfect sense that, you know, the Ministry of Defense just got rid of the president if he was being inconvenient.
Yeah.
And it's...
I respect Helldivers 2 a lot in the way they tell their story. It's kind of parallel to what we were just talking about with, like, Fanon. Because in a way, this is the opposite of, like, if a developer goes out of their way to add story beats based on player and fan response.
Yeah.
In this case, the game actions of players influence the story.
Yeah.
I think that is a really cool bit, and like you said, it more than justifies its sort of online-ness.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I believe that they do have an end-of-life plan, and yeah. I am happy that they do have an end-of-life plan, if they do. I'm not going to necessarily confirm that either, but I do assume that an end-of-life plan, though, will basically be a means to play missions with your friends.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, Helldivers, the main thing, the main reason I would say play it now, quote-unquote, is that, in a sense, it is limited time. There are only so many more storylines kind of left, quote-unquote. But, I mean, that's sort of what I'm here for as well. It's already been going for a year. I imagine it'll go for probably another 2, probably another 3. I would love if it went longer. But I imagine it'll go for a few more years and then have some kind of, you know, post-game mode once yeah. it is either definitively won or definitively lost.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you very much, Arrowhead. I hope that the video that I make does numbers. Can't wait to film that this weekend.
Joel, if you want to come on and talk about Splitgate.
Yeah, so...
We're not going to talk about that right now.
Yeah, we're not.
We've specifically said it prior to recording, we're not going to talk about Splitgate right now. So, okay, I've been playing Blueprints. I got it when it came out.
No. Blueprints.
I don't think so. So I got it when it came out. I've been loving it. I took a break because I reached the final room, room 46, I want to say. I don't remember. Maybe it's 42. Maybe it's 34. Room 34, of course. Don't go there. and then for people who've played it before, I've also gotten to room 8. But I'm in sort of Act 2 of the game, because Blueprints is, if you're not familiar, is a tile-drafting roguelite where you are the inheritor of a big fortune, including a big mansion or a big manor. Estate? And
unfortunately, your brother's been kidnapped and put into a painting.
Was that a reference to?
Luigi's Mansion.
Oh, I see. Luigi just wins a sweepstakes.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
A cheap sweepstakes.
I think that it should have been left in a will. They should have added to the Mario canon.
Yeah, their uncle Lothario.
who is canonically dead.
Okay, so Blueprints is a tile drafting game where you are exploring this manor and you open a door, and before you walk into the room, you have to choose what room is behind that door. And what you do is you draw 3 tiles and you get to choose one to place down. The rotation of the room is semi-random. Some of them have more consistent things. Obviously, like, if there's a straight room that just has the door you enter and the door you leave on the other side, there's only one way it can go. But for things like corners, you can't really choose which way it's facing. This being a roguelite, you can also reroll or get abilities to reroll and modify the drafting pool in some ways. For the most part, if you draft a room, it won't show up again. So there's strategies of, like, getting dead ends out of the way early. Additionally, some doors will be locked and you need keys. There's a key card system, and this gets to there's a whole lot of resource management going on. Makes it pretty compelling in that regard to me. But then also, it has escape room elements, where some rooms will have little self-contained riddles and puzzles. There's a math puzzle in the darts or in the billiards room using a dartboard. There's a logic puzzle that sucks in the parlor. It's one of those, like, one of these statements is true, the other one is false. Both statements are false, you idiot. And, like, there's all these rules you have to consider, and sometimes it's very unintuitive what it's actually telling you or wanting you to do. That being said, they get harder until you fail, and then they get easier again. Because, you know, you're playing this over multiple runs. Sometimes you'll get upgrades permanently. Other times you'll just get info. Sometimes you'll just do nothing. But there are also other mysteries. In fact, I have a tab in my notepads, program that's called Blueprints Remaining Mysteries, because it's got a lot.
Yeah, it's, hang on, let me just click it right here. And yeah, it just says, what that mouth do? That's gross. Why did you write that?
You don't understand. The mouth is so pivotal to the whole mystery.
Oh, I see. It's a metaphorical mouth.
No, it's a literal mouth. It's just pivotal to the mystery.
Oh, okay.
You gotta... There is an actual, storyline going on in a mystery that may or may not be a murder mystery to solve. But also, this is a puzzle hunt game where they will give you riddles in codes and clues to other things in the game that you have to find out and solve. For example, there are paintings on the walls of every room. I'm not going to say anything about them because that would spoil it, and I want to keep this spoiler free for the most part. But, you know, there's paintings on the walls of every room. They do something.
This is one of those games where the meta progress is you realizing, now hold on a second. This is actually, all these numbers go towards a cipher.
Yeah, to explain, or to better, further this point, in the early few rooms you find, you will have little note cards that are more or less tutorial info. Things like, if you have keys, you can open rooms with them, or sometimes you can find gold and spend it. And one of them is just, you should use a notebook. So I have my notebook. It has 7 pages currently with notes. I have my notepad, which has other things. And then I have my Steam screenshots folder, which is bloated with screenshots. It's great and I love it. It makes me want to pull my hair out. I think notebook games are on the rise. Animal Well last year was a very surprising hit, I think, because while there was a lot of things that are obviously good and fun and appealing, like the cute little potato character or just all the animals, at the same time, it kind of smoothly led players into the puzzle hunting while also giving enough of an end point to end on.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people in Blueprints, they get to that final room, which is sort of the end point, and that already requires solving quite a bit of mysteries. But I think a lot of people are still choosing to go on and pursue the further mysteries, when in previous games like Animal Well, they might not have been interested. I will note that I am approaching this like I did Animal Well, where I'm not expecting to get everything by myself. I think that is sort of a healthy mindset to have when it comes to puzzle hunt style games.
Yeah.
Games that are like Sokoban type puzzle games or logic puzzles, or even like detective games like Oberdin or Golden Idol, where they're more self-contained murder mysteries. I think those you can obviously be like, oh, I'll solve this on my own. But I think when it comes to this is a cipher that involves deciphering information that might not be obvious, I'm a lot more inclined to go along with the MIT mystery hunt method of you need a team of 20 to 30 people to solve this shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that, though. I mean, we talked about this in the Animal Well episode, but that's not what I want to talk about right now. What I want to talk about is sort of the discourse surrounding Blueprints.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily about the puzzles either. There are some puzzles that I really disliked, but it's not really the fault of the game. It's more my fault for interpreting things wrong. Again, not going to spoil those because that would spoil the solution. And I haven't finished the game and I've taken a break because it's a puzzle game and I like to take breaks for puzzle games. But when I hear people talk about this game, I so often hear people talk about how it wastes your time. And I think that's a really complicated topic. Because for the most part, almost every room has something important. As you continue through the game, you'll start to cross off those checkboxes. And towards the end game, it'll come to the point where you need a specific room in your house. I think there is a boiler room that's really kind of bad about this in that it's not something that you'll be able to intentionally get going, I think. You kind of have to wait for it to be offered to you. But the problem is that, if hypothetically the only puzzle you had remaining involved that room, then you would have to just brute force it. And it's kind of complicated to me because Blueprints is a roguelite. It is a game where you lose a lot, and there are strategies to avoid losing to an extent. It's also a game where you improve your options as you play so that further subsequent runs are better. And at the start of the game, the rate that you uncover these new mysteries and puzzles and the rate that you're able to solve them is definitely faster. But as the game goes on and things get more complicated, it gets harder to solve them. And so I think it becomes a bit slower paced. There's less being introduced, so things don't feel as fresh. But I don't know if that's considered, like, wasting my time. The big problem, again, is that, like, because it is a roguelite with randomness, there is a chance that you can't do the thing you want because you didn't draw it. Or there's a chance that you draw tiles and get thrown into a dead end. I will note that as I've started to, like, intentionally get as many dead ends early on as possible, for example, I have had a lot more success in getting to the final row in the final room, as well as, like, there are a lot of other rules relating to room distribution and drafting and stuff like that that are, I think, not obvious on purpose, so there is sort of depth involved. And also, like, the list of mysteries I have is still like 30 things plus long, and there's still a lot that I'm like, I'm not gonna write it down because I don't know if there's anything here, but there's a chance it's important, so I'm gonna keep it in mind.
Yeah.
So like, I think it's kind of hard to talk about because like, if I were to play Isaac, for example, Binding of Isaac, and I'm playing it with the intention of unlocking an achievement which unlocks an item, so like playing, I don't know, Azazel in trying to get the Delirium. There's a chance I don't get to Delirium that run and I just die. Or there's even a chance that the items I get are so bad that it's impossible for me to get to Delirium. Like Ludovico Technique and Spoonbender.
There is a chance that you're, like, even if you have put in the best effort, you are not going to be able to progress. And in a sense, that means that you have wasted your time.
Yeah. And, like, it does kind of suck to be put in that situation, but I'm never really deterred by it, and I never really feel like it's a problem with the game. If I'm playing a regular roguelite or roguelike, I kind of go in assuming that's part of the deal, that I am being sold a game where sometimes you will just lose, and minimizing the losses is the goal of the game more so than winning every time. No shade to people who can win every time. Those people fucking rule. But, like, I kind of understand it intuitively to be part of the game and part of the appeal in a way. Like, yeah, sometimes you don't get any good jokers in Balatro.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, I feel like to Blueprints's problem, I think a lot of people recognize that there are these puzzles and they might know the solution, or at least they're really sure of a solution that they want to try. But it feels like the randomness is more of a roadblock. There's sort of an adage in puzzle game design of, like, don't make the solution hard once the player knows the solution. That, like, if the player knows what to do, they should be able to do it to solve the puzzle then. Because knowing what to do is the challenge.
Yeah.
But Blueprints is overtly a game where the challenge is also navigating a roguelite maze. And so, like, it's kind of hard for me to fully agree that it's wasting time. And part of me just thinks that, like, because it has these puzzle elements, people want to approach it as a regular puzzle game.
Yeah.
I want to shout out Dis Pontibus, which is a game by Marcos, who makes a lot of puzzle game prototypes on Twitter. but it's also a roguelite puzzle game in that it has randomly generated puzzles, or procedurally generated, I guess. And they're always solvable, but they're so complicated that I've gotten seeds where it's like, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
And in that instance, I don't really feel like it's a problem with the game. I feel like it's just a problem with me. And in Blueprints, when I get a situation where I'm like, well, I don't have any more keys and I don't know, you know, I don't have access to this thing I was looking for, I'll just look around all the rooms I have and see if there's anything I missed.
Yeah.
The process of double checking, I think, is really important, especially in a game where you have to keep a scrapbook of, like, newspaper clippings. So, yeah, I don't know. It's complicated. There is one resource I have completely trivialized now, I don't know how many resources you can do that with in the post game. And I think, like, there are a lot of puzzles that I really did value, but, like, I was streaming pretty much the entire thing on Twitch, and I never really felt like I got a run where nothing happened.
Yeah.
Maybe I couldn't solve a puzzle, and, like, I didn't know what to do from that point on, but I felt like most of my runs either ended pretty quickly at, like, the 5-minute mark, or I got a long time and was able to make progress on something. And maybe that's just my experience. I mean, it's definitely not a game for anyone. And in a way,
it's not a game for everyone. You said it's not a game for anyone.
Oh, well, sorry. This game isn't for you.
Yeah, okay.
You see, it's about a big house that shifts and turns and twists.
And
there's somebody dead, probably. I don't know. I've definitely compared it to House of Leaves in a, like, article I'm working on.
The prints were blue.
I mean, it's also... The house is blue, though.
Oh, yeah. No, I have seen it. Little house is blue, so...
So, I mean, not... The other thing is, it's very easy to compare it to Betrayal at House on the Hill, because the tiles that you draft look like Betrayal tiles. And Betrayal tiles look like Zelda rooms or a lot of other tile placement games. But the layout of the rooms and the way the text is applied to it is so Betrayal-coded that I kind of love it.
Yeah.
Betrayal at House on the Hill is a great game because it's kind of a roguelite, but nobody might win. Everybody might lose. And, you know, that's fine. That's part of the fun of playing it. I never feel like my time is wasted if, you know, somebody gets a haunt where everyone has to jump out of a bird and the bird kills us all. it's complicated. I don't think people are wrong to say that it felt like it wasted their time, because ultimately how you feel is yourself. Maybe the popularity of notepad champ games is a double-edged sword. But I do think that 2026 or 7 would be a great year to release Mulana 3.
Yeah.
I think people are finally ready for Mulana.
Yeah.
The amount of people who I feel like would never think about playing a puzzle game that requires a notebook, that love taking notes for blueprints, I'm like, we're so there. We're so there. They're going to learn about how to enter Eden. At the foot of the dancing man. Yeah. I don't know. Blueprints, pretty good game. I like it. It's exactly my type of thing. I'm not surprised if its wider appeal is sort of not quite, I don't want to say earned, but for the niche that it's in, it feels like it should have been more niche than it became.
Yeah. But if it might have gotten, like, more eyes on it because of, like, streamers or something.
Yeah. Northern Lion played it. Northern Lion's the new Germa.
Yeah.
As we all know. But if you like Blueprints, play La Mulana 1 and 2. The second one's better. Don't tell anyone I said that. Okay. A few quick notes. Mario Kart World.
Mario Kart World. Oh my goodness.
Beautiful. Beautiful game. They let you jump. It's fucked up. There's real tech.
They let you jump. They put Peach in a street outfit.
They put Mario in a suit. And if you're in free roam, you never run out of go back in time potion.
Nice.
The open world is actually great.
Yeah, yeah. Fucking, we're finally, we're fucking living the dream of SSX 3 too.
Like, the open world is great. Knockout races could be better. I'm not going to go too into detail in it. One thing I do want to go in meticulous detail is that they have a lot of cute references and nods. For example, specifically with the characters, you can play as, like, anyone, not just Mario characters like Mario and Luigi and people with proper noun names, but also enemies. You can play as a snowman. You can play as a cow. Cows are enemies. You can play as a penguin. You can play as a dolphin. But a lot of the enemies have a lot of really cute little references in their animations. So you can do tricks in this game. You can do tricks on it. The dolphin, when it does a trick, the animations it does make it look like the dolphin sprites from Super Mario World, either the vertical dolphin or the side dolphin. Likewise, the charge and chuck, when it does a trick, sometimes it'll do a clap, which is one of the properties of the charge and chucks in Mario World.
Yeah.
Those are just two examples of, like, references to an older game. The snowman, I think, has some animations that are almost just lifted from Mario 64, for example. I want to say the swooper like wipes its eyes at the start of a race because it's too early for it. It should be in bed.
That's really cute.
Yeah. It's really cute is how I would put it. Really charming. Yeah,
Mario Kart World is a very charming game. I want to have a Switch too. It's unfortunately Nintendo fucking knocked it out of the goddamn park. It's a really interesting, like really interesting development for the series.
Speaking of knocking things, last note from me is a bit of a pinball corner. So first, Stern King Kong, great table. Keith Elwin knows how to design them. It does the thing where there's not really a great place to plunge. If you're good enough, you can plunge into the river consistently. That's what I recommend. And then hitting the gong while the ball save is on. If you're on premium. If you're in pro, you don't need to worry about the gong. It's a great game. It has really fun flow and interesting shots. I just think the middle post sucks ass. It has a lot of references to other tables as well, which is pretty common at this point. But it has a T-Rex multi-ball that's pretty much just the T-Rex multi-ball from Jurassic Park. It has a mana overboard call-out in mode that is similar to the one from Whitewater. And they just added a combo shot that's almost the exact same as the Picard maneuver from TNG. So, like, it has a lot of nice little touches for pinheads.
Yeah.
Now, the negative side... The news.
Yeah, the other side of the coin.
Jersey Jack released their Harry Potter table. And, you know, obligatory fuck J.K. Rowling.
Yep,
fuck
of course, of course.
But to make things worse, not only are they taking a huge PR hit by doing this, they used AI for the play field.
Oh, no!
Yeah, so it wasn't on Pinsider, but it was I think Tilt Forums user made a big thread showing all these different AI artifacting within the table art. So things like hands looking weird, outfits being weird. A lot of times if there's a person, it was a screenshot from the movie run through a filter, which led to things like details on clothing turning into other things, like a number on a like jersey becoming a glove strap for some reason, because AI can't distinguish things.
Yep.
There's, like, the train is completely fucked up and mangled. It just doesn't look good. There's a lot of, like, where there's a corner for, like, an embellishment, there's a bunch of random lines and squiggles because it's artifacting and it doesn't know what to do. And so, like, it's so, so bad. This, by the way, is a... $12,000 pinball table. Jesus, pinball tables are expensive. They go for more than $10,000. And these are supposed to be collector's items. JJP, Jersey Jack Pinball, for a long time has sort of billed itself as like, we have more expensive tables because we have high quality collector's items. But this is like, not only is it Harry Potter, which is a controversial thing to say the least, but they used terrible, horrible Gen AI.
Yeah.
And compare that to how a really respected artist who goes by Zombie Yeti was recently made the head of art direction at Stern. And you can see that on the Kong playfield and backglass, where like the Kong playfield has like a temple over in the side with little temple ruins. And where the gong is, there's its own sort of images on the ground. And there's like greenery here and there representing the jungle. And like, you can really tell that there was intent behind this and that a human made the art for it. And it looks nice.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at this thing the whole game, you know. You gotta make it look nice. But, like, the fact that this was stuff from the movie put into a filter and then not even touched up to fix major errors. Yeah,
I'm startled by... I think the thing that I'm just startled at most is, like, specifically the fact that this is not, you know, budget conscious, you know, this is not the company that's like, hey, look, it's a pinball table. Like, this is, you know, collector's item. Pay a single artist $12,000 and they will make you something 20 times better and you will make that price back with selling so one table.
So, like, there are, I don't want to say budget, but there are smaller, like, independent pinball manufacturers and they typically save costs by using either more 3D printed components or just slightly less durable components, which often means that you have to repair them more.
Mm.
Ninja Eclipse by Turner Pinball is a great table that has unfortunate issues with that. But it's a great table and layout. But it also, hand-drawn art, completely yeah. made by a human. Like, they didn't need to skip out on paying an artist.
Yeah.
It might suck that, you know, the components are worse, but the whole thing is done by people. And I know I'm pretty sure anyone listening to us is going to have the same sort of opinion on Gen AI in general. I think that there are some times where it's okay, but only if it's completely trained in-house. Inzoi, for example, where it really doesn't work, but at least it's trained in-house.
Yeah.
You can tell it was because it really doesn't work. Or something like Suck Up, which was the vampire simulating game.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's used during the game to provide sort of dialogue. But, like, this is just blatant, like, we're cutting corners.
Yeah, yeah. And we fired Doug.
It's also wild because Jersey Jack has not had the best PR, like, throughout their whole run. Wizard of Oz and Hobbit are, and Pirates are definitely tables that are fancy, but not very fun. And then they had Dialed In and Toy Story, which were definitely better steps, I think, in terms of design. Though Dialed In is a bitch and a half. I hate the electrician. Worst character, biggest villain. And Toy Story 4 was a theme that a lot of people were more confused by, but I think it's one of their best. Godfather, really complicated design layout, and had the goofy gangster toy that people kind of joked about. But then they had Elton John, which was a great table designed by Steve Ritchie, who's like one of the goated game designers for pinball. And a lot of people were like, wow, Jersey Jack might be on the comeback. Like, the flippers feel great, the shots feel great. This is a great game. And then they made Avatar, which was kind of okay, but had the same Jersey Jack issue of being way too complicated. And then this, they had a slight incline in PR and reputation, and then they just tanked it. Meanwhile, Evil Dead is actually pretty decent, so Spooky is suddenly getting a bit more popular. And, like, Ninja Eclipse, great table, even though the components weren't great. And then Barrels of Fun just released Dune, which is phenomenal, alongside Labyrinth, which was a really good table as well. So, like, all these other, like, smaller companies are starting to bite at the heels.
Yeah.
And Jersey Jack's like, we're just gonna do this, like, really controversial theme, and then also we're going to do something even worse.
We're gonna just kind of slip this out there and hope nobody really notices or cares.
That their $14,000 collector's edition looks like shit.
Yeah, it looks like
I don't think the collector's edition has... Wait, no. I think the collector's edition has the same playfield art, but not the side and back glass art. So it's not really that much better. Yeah. Fuck JJP.
Yeah, like...
But King Kong's great. Ninja Eclipse is great. Dune's good. Yeah.
I've been playing a city builder game called Urbeck. That's been my new little game I've enjoyed. It's a city builder sort of inspired by Islanders, where things that are placed near other things are sort of the major component. So you place a house. If you want to upgrade it, you need to place a food market nearby. Oh, but the food market needs farms nearby. And once you have farms nearby, you can build a farmhouse. Etc. etc. It's really fun. You have to work around limited space and consider various needs.
It's a lot more of a strategy game than something like City Skylines.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
is like a creative tool or a sandbox. I've played a little bit of Urbeck. Some of the numbers scared me.
Yeah.
In just that it's a lot of numbers to keep track of.
Yeah,
but
that's fair.
It does have a really board gamey aspect of playing off adjacencies and like combos.
Yeah, it's
that
it's
I think
fun.
Is really clever.
It's also political in a very fun way, where like you can either get cops that will make sure that people don't become rebels, or you can allow there to be rebels, which adds to self-organization, which gets you various things like bike lanes and like anarchist communes and whatnot. Or if you go the police route way, you'll get like Ministry of Defense, and you have to go into religious buildings to get police stations, which is really funny.
Yeah. Any game that is based off of modeling human behavior ultimately
has to have an amount of
politics. Yeah, because it displays what the creator's beliefs on humanity are.
Yeah.
And so like you can get something that outright has negatives for like homelessness but doesn't give you a way to fix homelessness, or you can have things where like there are proposed solutions to homelessness used as mechanics.
Yeah,
or things like, you know, affordable housing, and then like the way you know it's like you're gonna have by default politics when making a game that where politics is sort of a mechanic in a way.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to embrace that, at least.
It's very good to embrace it rather than kind of try to ignore it. That's like, you know, City Skylines I like for a lot of reasons that I super won't get into because we're already at the end of the episode. But at a certain point, it's like, build a police station and a fire station and a healthcare and a blah, blah, blah. And it's like, why do I have to build a police station, though?
I like City Skylines because I watched a video of somebody designing a city based off the Voyager Golden Record, and I was like, this is great. Nice.
Yeah, City Skylines is probably still my general favorite, but Urbeck, I think, does a lot of very interesting things. If the developers ever made an Urbeck 2, I would probably super get into
it. It's the difference between Planet Coaster and Park Attack.
Yep, yep.
And I play those for different reasons.
Exactly. But speaking of playing for different reasons, I would like to go play a different reason to this podcast. That was a good transition, right? That was...
Yeah, I think it was pretty good. So, yeah, let's go ahead and call it there. A nice, quick episode. I hope we can do more episodes, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
But thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, we very much appreciate you listening.
If you want to hear when the next episode comes out, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like, where you can also give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what you think you want to hear from us talk about, that's a sentence, or let us know what you think we might be interested in. You can also follow us on Blue Sky at netsurferpro.bsky.social, where you can get teasers on upcoming episodes, as well as just updates on upcoming episodes. And I guess let's just go ahead and say you can also follow me on there at twack.bsky.social, where I've been doing a lot of pinball posting and plural posting and other posting. You can also follow me on Twitch on twitch.tv/twack, where I'm trying to stream more regularly, playing through Deltarune currently. That's something we didn't talk about.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about that.
Deltarune chapter 3 and 4. Oh boy. No spoilers towards me or from me or against me.
Anything you spoil can and will be held against you in a court of Toby Fox.
Yeah. So if you follow me on there, I've also got some interesting things planned for that in the future. So stay abreast of that, if you know what I mean.
And as for myself, you can find me on TikTok. You can find me on Blue Sky. You can find me on Tumblr at Galen Wilson. That is at GalenWilson 0n .bsky.social for bsky. I post my hot takes. I post videos of what I'm doing. I do various things. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube. And you can find me at TheIncredibleMRG.com, TheIncredibleMrG.com. I will have that up and running by the time this episode is up and running, hopefully. So, yay.
I think it's time for us to get up and running.
If you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, in fact, because I said it.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean.
You know what I mean.
But if you don't know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
then do I really know what you mean?
What do you mean?